Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. What does the first mutiny in North American history tell us about the great age of exploration? Henry Hudson was a renowned explorer at the time of William Shakespeare. Starting in 1607, Hudson led four expeditions, including one for the Dutch, who'd hired him to help colonize what would become New York City. Hudson was a veteran of navigating the North Atlantic to the New World. Yet this fourth voyage started off unlucky and got worse. Trapped by the ice in Hudson Bay, he ordered his men to hunker down for the winter, and in the spring they'd renew their trip westward. But his crew barely survived the brutal winter, and a sizable portion didn't want to continue. What happened next is still a matter of debate. Peter Mancall is a professor of history and anthropology at the University of Southern California. He is the author and editor of several books on North America in the Age of Discovery. His new history is called Fatal Journey, The Final Expedition of Henry Hudson. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You've lived in Connecticut and in Boston. Have you ever spent the winter in Canada?
I have to confess that I have not had the pleasure of doing so.
I've spent 3 weeks in northern Michigan, and that's about as close to Hudson Bay as I want to get to.
I can understand that. And actually, from reading the documents from the 17th century, I don't think I'm going to be booking passage for a winter in Hudson's Bay.
Well, to help us set some of the background, before we get to Henry Hudson, I wanted to ask you a couple things that I learned in reading the book. We know that 100 years after Columbus, the early English explorers were still trying to find a shortcut to China.
Correct.
They didn't care about the New World that much. They were after the spices in the Far East. Now, I knew all that. What I didn't know was that the spices were highly valued, not because Europeans found that they liked a little nutmeg in their gruel, but because they thought the spices were miracle cures.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about sort of, you know, early American history, you know, which we read in the textbooks, and we just presume that the English, you know, wanted to go set up at Jamestown or wanted to go to Plymouth. You know, when we get back into those documents from the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century, I mean, what's on a lot of these people's minds are, you know, what sort of resources are out there beyond Europe that they could possibly extract. And so spices had become just sort of this rave, you know, in Europe in the 16th century. I mean, spices from the Southwest Pacific, from the so-called Spice Islands, had been coming to Europe already, you know, through an overland trail along the old Silk Route, and they'd been coming. The Portuguese had been bringing them, you know, a very long ocean journey. But what Europeans, especially the English, wanted were they wanted those spices because they believed that they would cure so many of the afflictions in their lives. And so we think of them now as, you know, we have a dish that needs a little brightening in some sense. We pour a little spice on it. But, I mean, they are thinking, oh, if I could only get some cinnamon, you know, it's going to solve my upset stomach. Or if I could get some cloves into my diet, I could really clear up my eyesight. Or, you know, one of the great sort of afflictions of the 16th century, it could strengthen what they called a weak brain. You know, if they could get some mace, it might ease heartburn. Nutmeg, they would use for a dysentery or for insomnia. And then the greatest of these spices in terms of medicinal value were just peppers, which, you know, there was just this huge variety of things that you could do with them. They could break a fever. They could stop a cough. They could get rid of gout or sciatica. They could ease headaches. They could cure tonsillitis. If you had intestinal worms that would chase them away, if you had sores left over from a bout of leprosy, you could get rid of them. I mean, these spices to Europeans were just the miracle drugs of the day, and getting them would really just improve their lives immeasurably.
And this underscores a fact that many people may not realize, that although the expeditions were licensed and sanctioned by the governments, they were, for the most part, private, profit-seeking ventures. And because of this whole spice as miracle cure, it put the Age of Discovery in a different light for me. It's as if we launched the space program because we wanted to harvest the moon because we thought it was full of penicillin and Viagra.
That is an excellent way of thinking about it. Exactly. They were private ventures. I mean, the ones that I really focus on, that is the English ones, they're private ventures because of sort of the nature of the way the state had developed. That is, there were close connections between wealthy investors and the crown. But when it came down to it, I mean, it's a very expensive proposition to launch an expedition, you know, across the world. And in England, at least, those costs had to be borne by private investors. And they absolutely anticipated huge profits if their, whoever they supported, could come back alive and bring back these wonder drugs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Peter Mancall, and we're talking about the possible murder of the great English explorer Henry Hudson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. The other thing that struck me about these early explorers, the British ones in particular, is that they were constantly underprepared for what they found. They're always starving or freezing to death. And as you explained, that's because they didn't understand that Europe's mild climate is essentially an aberration. When you look at the globe, England and France are actually further north than Maine or Minnesota, but the prevailing winds and ocean currents keep European weather mild. Now, I understand that. I understand that they made this sort of fundamental miscalculation. But by the time of Hudson, they'd been coming to the New World for decades. Henry Hudson himself had been here twice. And yet they still came, it seemed, completely unprepared for the weather.
Well, it does seem so in retrospect. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that all historians are trying to battle is, you know, sort of the sense that, well, you know, we know something that they didn't know. But you were right, that by the time Hudson is sailing, there had been a fair number of people who traveled back and forth, especially in the North Atlantic, you know, because there had been a lot of fishermen going to haul all that cod back to Europe. So there had been a lot of trips, most of which are completely undocumented. I mean, we really don't know what happened, but there's certainly some sort of, you know, common experience. And yet, even though there is this sort of accretion of knowledge, you know, over time, there are still, in the geography books from the 16th century, you know, Europe's leading geographers and map makers are still theorizing about the world and still holding to these very, you know, this very powerful idea that a place in one latitude will have the same climate as a place, you know, elsewhere in the world on that same latitude. I mean, they're really, that sticks for a long time, that idea. I mean, you could argue that doesn't really begin to fundamentally break down until the 19th century. But in the 17th century, they're still there. And so they are trying to figure it out. And when I talk to people about the book, people often are sort of, you know, surprised, like, well, why didn't they know X, Y, or Z? And I think, in part, it's that they knew some of these things, but there are these conflicting sources of authority that they're battling. And part of it is they just want to believe, you know, that there is this water route through North America, and they believe that they'll be able to withstand it with the way they've equipped themselves.
The third thing I wanted to bring up brings us to Henry Hudson's last days. At the time, the term mutiny did not refer to events specifically on board a ship. It mostly just meant an insurrection. In fact, when the sailors on the Discovery got back to England, they were not charged with mutiny because it didn't even exist as a crime. I wonder if you could explain what was the fear that eventually motivated their trial and what were they tried for?
Well, you point to one of the things that actually was a discovery for me when I wrote the book also, because I'd known about the story of Hudson, and I went into it, and I just sort of, you know, presumed, you know, that there was the story of this mutiny, and therefore they would have been charged with mutiny. And then I discovered and asked various law librarians their opinion, just discovered that under English law, the first law of mutiny is not until 1689. And in fact, that law, when it was written, is really about soldiers in the king's army on land. It's not even directly relevant to the sea. So what's going on with the Hudson story is these mutinies, purported mutineers, come back, or these people come back. They actually, of course, say they were not involved in the mutiny. They come back, and that would eventually motivate, and there's a hearing immediately with a group called the Masters of Trinity House, which is not really, we don't have modern equivalents for it. It was a guild that had been set up in the 16th century to help regulate what happened on English ships abroad, English ships when they're out on the sea. And so the survivors come and they say, okay, oh, here's this terrible story and whatever. But the Masters of Trinity House have no real legal authority, or if they do, they don't exercise it in this case.
And they're primarily concerned about what happened to the Northwest Passage,
exactly.
You know, and what happened to any property or profits or what? It's
exactly.
All the business.
I mean, they are very much sort of, how do we stop future problems like this? And by the way, I mean, their inquiry very quickly turns to, and is there that passage there, and how could we find that passage, and these very specific details. Then a few years pass, and a couple of the guys involved with survivors of Hudson's voyage actually go on other voyages into the North Atlantic. But then 1617, something has happened which prompts a trial of four of the survivors. And the depositions which survive from that trial have this very interesting thread in them. These people are asked, first the deposition suggests that they're asked, well, what happened? And then the people asking the questions, that is someone for the High Court of Admiralty, basically said, was this an act of piracy? And this, you know, sort of puzzled me at first until I then realized that this is a period of very intense English fear about the Barbary pirates working off the coast of Africa and the capture of Protestant English sailors who would be taken and sold into slavery in Islam. And so there's this heightened concern with piracy. So they asked these survivors, you know, were they pirates? Did they intend to become pirates? And the deponents have slightly different answers. But at the end of these depositions, they decide, well, they have to charge them with something. And so they eventually charge them with murder for exposing Hudson and leading to his presumed death. And so hence it becomes a murder trial, and then, as I point out in the book, they're acquitted.
Well, one of the reasons it struck me they couldn't be tried for piracy is that, as you point out, piracy is a crime against property. It's a form of theft. And they did bring Hudson's ship back.
Yes, exactly.
So they couldn't be accused of piracy.
Right. Well, in that sense, that's right. And that is the most valuable thing associated with the voyage, with any of these voyages, was the ship itself. And so by bringing the Discovery back, they have sort of indicated that obviously they are not pirates.
So let's go back to the onboard ship, the Discovery, early 1611. What did these crew members do? And what are the reasons we might not believe them today? And we'll come to that after the break. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour to historian Peter Mancall. We're talking about the possible murder of the great English explorer Henry Hudson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. And Peter, just before the break, I asked you to take us back to Discovery on board ship early 1611. And just what did Henry Hudson's crew do?
Okay, so in late 1610, that is the late autumn of 1610, late summer, I should say, of 1610, Hudson and his men had to make a decision whether they were going to sail home or whether they were going to stay basically in Hudson's Bay, or what is in Hudson's Bay, for the winter. Hudson understood from all that he'd read and from his experience sailing that the ship would become encased with ice and they would be trapped there for X number of months until the ship was freed. And then they could continue their explorations. The alternative would be to get home before ice choked off the passage, basically, to what is now Hudson Strait. They decide to stay there, and so they, as far as we can tell from the documents, they guide the ship as far south as they can. So it goes into what is now called James Bay. And by November, ice encircles the ship, and the ship is trapped. and that the ship remains there until June. So there are these 20 men and two boys on this ship for this winter of 7 months, basically in very cold, presumably very dark captivity, which they survive. I mean, one man dies during the winter, but that's it, and the others all survive. And so the basic business of what they're doing is just trying to get by when spring starts to come, but the ship is still encased in ice. Hudson realizes that if he can make contacts with local indigenous people, which in that area is the Cree, he might be able to get some supplies to help the men survive. And so he goes off looking for Cree. And at one point, a Cree man comes upon the discovery and trades with them, although he never comes back again. When the ship finally thaws in June, after these months of grumbling, one can only imagine very intense grumbling, the ship becomes free, it starts to sail out, and then that's when the purported mutiny takes place.
Now, we have testimony from the trial, but and in particular we have Abacook Prickett's account. And he's one of the sailors. We have his account, but there are questions because it's clearly a somewhat self-serving account of the events. And after their testimony, or rather during the trial, some contradictory evidence comes up. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, there's all sorts of, this is where the historian has to sort of try to peel off the layers of the past, the documentation. And so the major documentation we have is this narrative by Prickett. And we know that Prickett is on the ship. But we don't have the actual manuscript. That is, we don't have anything in Prickett's hand. What we have instead is a printed version of it, which is printed in 1625. So it's printed by a man named Samuel Purchase, whose goal is to really sort of promote English expansion. He's following his predecessor, a man named Richard Hakluyt. And so that document has to be looked on, with a certain amount of skepticism, in part because it is, as you put it perfectly, so incredibly self-serving. That is, Prickett writes, in this document, yes, there was this mutiny. He describes the mutiny, and then he goes on to describe the fact how none of the survivors, the people who actually made it back to London, were actually involved in the mutiny. And so then on top of his narrative, which is the core for what we know, so that is we have to deal with it somewhat skeptically, then we have these inquiries. And so we have little bits of evidence that add on to that. And so those bits of evidence include the initial testimony in front of the Masters of Trinity House in 1611, a physical examination of the ship, which is really an interesting bit of evidence, which I'll get to in a second, then the depositions themselves of some of the survivors, and then this very fragmentary court record, which notes that they are those who actually made it through the trial are not guilty. The physical examination of the ship turns up two crucial details. First, there's blood on the ship. There's blood stains on the ship, and the people who come back need to explain why there are these blood stains. And second, when the Masters of Trinity House, who were the first ones to get their hands on the ship, when they do their search of the ship, they find a desk. And in the desk is a note written by the ship's mathematician, a guy named Thomas Widows. In this age when Europeans are trying to chart unknown lands, a theory developed on the continent, that which eventually the English embraced, that they should take mathematicians along, because mathematicians would know how to use these tools and be able to chart things more accurately. Well, Widows is one of the people who, with Hudson and Hudson's son and several others, is gotten rid of in the alleged mutiny. But there's this note, which they find in the desk, which reveals these earlier tensions on board the ship. And there's this moment in the depositions, this sort of really interesting moment in the depositions, where you can just sort of, recreate the scene in your mind, of the people of the high court are saying, well, what about this note that we have? Did you know about this? And you can sort of almost sense that the deponents thought, whoa, we didn't actually know about that. But then they somehow manage to explain enough that in the end they're acquitted.
We should explain that the story that the mutinous crew members give is that they did not murder Henry Hudson. They put him, his son, and the other loyal crew members into a small boat and set them adrift with some supplies and some weapons and things.
Exactly. And I should have, yeah. amplified on that.
And so that's why the blood was so suspicious. It looked like they'd actually murdered him on board.
Exactly. And that's why Prickett's explanation, you know, is really so, you know, fantastic or incredible, you know, in the literal sort of sense of the word. That is, Prickett says, it was terrible. These things happened to Hudson, his son, the mathematician, the ship carpenter, a few other guys. We got rid of them. But we did so, basically, other than tying up Hudson, or the mutineers did so, nonviolently. That is, no one was injured during this. This is his story. But then as discovery starts to make its way northward along the eastern edge of Hudson's Bay, they see a group of Inuit on the shore. Five of the guys, including Prickett, go over to the shoreline, and they think they're going to trade with the Inuit. The English thought this would be great because they could gather some supplies that they need, and the Inuit presumably thought they could get things from the English. This is a fairly common practice, even by the early 17th century, of this trade. For reasons that the English don't explain, the Inuit purportedly turn on these men and mortally wound four of them. And then the crucial detail in Prickett's narrative, which becomes vital for understanding what happens on the ship, is that the guys make it back to the ship, where basically they bleed to death on the decks. And that then becomes the explanation for why there's blood there, thereby getting rid of the possibility that the blood was Hudson's.
Now, to modern eyes, whatever method they used, it seems to me that the men committed murder. However it was accomplished. I mean, setting him adrift in the middle of Hudson Bay, it was like leaving someone behind on Mars or something. It was extremely unlikely that they were ever going to survive or get back, yet they're acquitted. Why? What was the thinking that would lead to that?
Well, that is a great question, and I've been, you know, going over that in my mind since I started this project. So you're absolutely right that they're charged with murder because they've exposed Hudson. And as soon as discovery gets back to England, there's this presumption that Hudson is dead, that leaving him behind meant a death sentence. Now, there are, you know, modern writers who could suggest that, in fact, you could rig up one of these small boats, this little shallop, and sort of make your way back to England. That is, small craft have made it. But what Hudson would have presumably known is the story of what happened to some people left behind by the Frobisher journeys in the 1570s, where some men, who were left behind were never seen again, and, as we now believe, probably tried to sail back and disappeared. And so they are left with this situation then that court is basically saying, well, Hudson probably didn't try to sail back. He probably stayed there, thinking he'd be saved, and therefore he died, and so hence it had to be murder. Going over the laws from the time, in some sense, it was the right thing to charge them with. I mean, they did, the mutineers did, in fact, expose him. They didn't kill him on the spot, but they did expose him, and it was extremely unlikely that he survived very long. I mean, I argue in the book, I think he survived into the next winter, I speculate. But it's tantamount to murder. It's exactly, I mean, your analogy of leaving someone on Mars is exactly right.
I could see, as I said, that to modernize, the crewman committed murder. But I could also see that a case could be made if the murder wasn't justified, the mutiny was. Because the men were being led by Hudson, who had not really prepared them for what they were attempting. It was supposed to be a short trip. And there wasn't any talk at the beginning that, oh, we're going to spend, you know, a year sitting here frozen in Canada. And so I can see, I mean, the mutiny is somewhat justified, it would seem to me, except there is that contradictory evidence of the document that you mentioned, which indicated that the mutiny might have been motivated not by questions of, you know, food or where are we going, but by long-standing arguments.
Right. I mean, I think it's clear. I mean, when we look at Prickett's narrative, there is this sort of, you know, very revealing moment in it. But again, now he is promoting himself and making a case that he is innocent of anything that happened. But there's this moment in it where he recreates a dialogue that purportedly happened on the ship that said, well, if we do this, you know, if we go back to England and we leave Hudson behind, we'll be hanged, you know, for this crime. And one of the guys steps forward and says, no, we can argue, exactly along with what you were saying, we can argue that Hudson basically misled us. Specifically, they can say, as they do say, Hudson was hoarding food for himself to give out to his favorites. And then sort of an almost opposite charge, one of the things they wanted was they didn't want Hudson to give any food to men who were already injured or infirm in the document. We don't know what's wrong with them, but the thinking that these people probably wouldn't survive. And so what the purported mutineers wanted to do was to get rid of the weak men who would die, get rid of Hudson, who had been storing the food and sort of treating them unfairly, as they thought, go back and say, you know, for the good of the investors of this company, we did the only rational thing. We got rid of a commander who was really just leading us to our doom. And so you're absolutely right that they could have felt a sense of betrayal at the way that Hudson was behaving.
We're talking to Peter Mancall. This is a Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks. Peter is a historian, and we're talking about the possible murder of the great English explorer Henry Hudson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. I have an email here from Thomas. Does your guest have any opinions on whether Hudson would have been successful if he had departed for the Northwest Passage at a different time of year, avoiding the frigid Canadian winter?
We live in such an it's a great question for the moment in which we live, because global warming raises the theoretical possibility, you know, that a ship now could or will, you know, be able to make its way through. But in the 17th century, before that era, there was just no way through. I mean, Hudson is not the only one who failed to trying to get through. A number of expeditions failed looking for the Northeast Passage. John Davis had failed in the 1590s. William Baffin would fail in the mid-16-teens. I mean, there is, with the technology that they had, the ships they were on, and the frigidity of the winter, even if they timed it exactly right, that is, left England at the earliest possible moment to hit, you know, the longest of the Arctic summer, they would not, at that point, have had a chance to make it through.
This is
a great question.
This is something you mentioned in part. The method for dispatching Hudson and his son and the other victims, that is, letting them adrift in a boat with some supplies, is exactly the same method used more than 150 years later on the HMS Bounty with Captain Bligh. But this is something you didn't mention that it struck me. Curiously, Shakespeare, who writes The Tempest in 1610 and 1611, which means he couldn't know about Hudson's disappearance.
Correct.
But in The Tempest, Prospero describes the same thing happening to him when his wicked brother usurps his throne. Prospero and his daughter Miranda are set adrift. And so I was wondering, is this pretty much standard practice, or did you come across other mutinies, other cases in which people on board ship simply let someone adrift?
You know, that is a really smart and great question, and I can't say that there is a standard practice. And again, it sort of goes back to the sources that we have, and in this case, you know, what we have is, you know, basically Prickett's narrative, and then these answers to the questions for the High Court of Admiralty, and it is fairly clear to me that what they want to emphasize there is. They want to tell a story that de-emphasizes the possibility that they committed any violence towards Hudson. And so they can say it was terrible. Hudson was put on this little ship, you know, and pushed away, and therefore, you know, was going to be doomed as a result. But that Prickett or others, you know, might have thought of this almost as a non-violent act. Like, they understood the consequences of the act. But they didn't. I mean, nothing would have stopped the mutineers from killing Hudson on the spot. In fact, that might have happened. That might explain the blood, for all we know. But I think that what's going on is, I don't think there's a plan for this, or at least not a plan when the guys get on the ship. Remember, they were trapped for 7 months, you know, from November to June, November 10 to June of 1611. And invariably, various scenarios must have gone through their mind, and they hatched about this. But I don't think, you know, I have no evidence which suggests that the men who hatched the mutiny really, you know, would have studied other mutinies or heard much about them. I think they were just looking for what seemed to them a reasonable solution to a very pressing problem.
I could also see that it's not the easiest thing to murder someone. I mean, physically, in cold blood right there. It does seem somewhat more merciful to simply let them adrift.
It does, exactly. And remember, one of the people we're talking about is Hudson's son, who's 17 years old. You know, so even if they didn't like Hudson, and certainly this, the doctors suggest they didn't like Hudson very much, I mean, it's a very difficult thing, exactly. I mean, these are people who've lived in close quarters throughout the winter. They've gotten to know each other well. And even though they might have hated each other, it's a very big step from that sort of animosities that might build up in those months to, you know, actually killing someone.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. We're talking about the disappearance of the great English explorer Henry Hudson, and we'll be back after the break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, and we're back with historian Peter Mancall and our talk about Henry Hudson, the great English explorer who disappeared in northern Canada in 1611. And we were talking about how the men dispatched Hudson, supposedly, whether or not it was murder, whether it constituted mutiny, and what all of that meant. And I was wondering, as you say in the book, you have to deal with, you know, shards and little fragments of evidence. We don't have a full account of what went on, and you have to deal with layers of interpretation. From next year, it'll be 400 years ago. So what happens afterwards? It's not for, you know, decades that anyone gets back in that area, anyone from England gets back in that area. What do they find, if anything?
Well, so in the immediate aftermath of it, there are other expeditions which start to go towards that area, and they mostly end up concentrating on sort of trying to chart the western coast of Greenland, although some do go, you know, into Hudson's Bay. But if there's any effort to find Hudson, it's fruitless. It's unclear what happened. The next thing we know is that in the 1630s, Captain Thomas James, who is an incredibly talented writer, among other things, he goes down, he sails into James Bay is named after him. He sails into this area, and as he is sort of poking around there, he finds these two sharpened stakes in the ground, which he surmises have been sort of shaped or chopped by an English or European-style hatchet. And then he sort of
because
wonders,
it would looked like it had been used a metal.
Exactly, right, as opposed to, say, a stone axe, which local people would have used beforehand. And so he sort of, and there are these two stakes which are sort of near the coastline. And so the logical inference to make from that, you know, is that someone might have, somebody from England or from Europe, it was probably England in this case, used them to tie up a boat. And the reason we can make that inference is because local Inuit and Cree paddled around these areas in very light kayaks, which when they weren't using them, they pulled them, you know, up onto the shore, and there would have been no real reason to tie them up. And so it was in the way that these little stakes were cut, there's a sense that maybe, say, the ship Carpenter, for example, might have done this to moor their shallop if it still existed. The better evidence comes another 40 years later, so now we're in 1671, or about 60 years after the mutiny, and there is a much larger English expedition to the area. Two large ships are there, and on one of them there's a man named Thomas Gorst. And Gorst overwinters in James Bay in, as far as we can tell, more or less the same area where Hudson had been. And Gorst, as the ice releases his ship so he can sail back to London in that next year, he starts poking around, and he gets on a little shallop, same kind of boat that Hudson was on, same kind of little ship, little vessel Hudson was on. And he starts poking around. And Gorst had spent the winter with a lot of contact with the Cree, with Cree Indians. And so he had some understanding of how they lived, and especially sort of the structures they built for various seasons. And so as he's poking around before he leaves, he comes across the ruins of a structure which he writes in his diary, found a place not of the Indian construction. This must be where Hudson died. It's a very compelling little reference. Gorst does not say specifically where it is. No archaeologist has ever found the site, despite many people looking, for where did Hudson end his days. But nonetheless, it does seem to suggest that there's a good chance that Hudson and these people on the shallop made it to a little island in James Bay, built themselves some sort of a structure, and tried to wait it out. And I think, in Hudson's mind, wait for someone to come rescue him, and those rescuers never showed up.
To this point, we have a very interesting question from Mark in Irving. Your guest mentioned the native inhabitants of the area. Is there perhaps any evidence in the oral or written histories of the area that inhabitants might have that would shed light on what happened to Hudson, perhaps indicating that Hudson or members of his party took refuge with local peoples where they eventually died as members of the tribe?
That is a great question, and in fact, this is the kind of question which these kinds of relations are what I've spent most of my career working on, that is early interactions between European explorers or colonists and native peoples. There are some hints in the oral record. There's one oral testimony which becomes recorded, finally written in written down, I should say, recorded, kept orally, in 1985, which suggests, which sort of tells about purportedly the first time Cree saw Europeans arrive. And then there are these legends that have indeed survived around Hudson's Bay, these stories, these legends, that maybe the Cree had, or Inuit, had taken in at least Hudson's son. I think there is no doubt in my mind that Hudson and the men on the shallop realized that their best chance for survival would in fact have been to find the Cree and to hope that they would be taken in. And there's certainly, I think, a lot of other examples which suggest that the Cree might have been receptive to that, because a number of indigenous peoples were receptive to dealing with Europeans, especially because Europeans had goods that the natives didn't produce for themselves. But in this case, there is no compelling evidence that anyone has ever found that suggests that Hudson and the boy and the other men were taken in. I mean, I very much wanted to find that evidence, but there is none.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, and we're talking to historian Peter Mancall about the disappearance of the English explorer Henry Hudson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. Getting back to what Hudson was doing there, what do you think of the theory that he wasn't looking for the Northwest Passage? That, in fact, Hudson didn't have letters of introduction or gifts for any Chinese potentates, which other explorers had carried with them. And this theory is that Hudson was hanging around Hudson Bay and exploring, really because he was surveying the area for a future colony for the investors.
That theory certainly exists, and I know that people have argued it. And there are a couple of issues, and it raises sort of questions about, how different historians interpret the past. I mean, on the one hand, we don't know all the things that Hudson might or might not have had in his possession. Trying to get the exact details of what people had on these ships is a very difficult process. And what we tend to have, every now and then we get an inventory of sort of the goods that they stored, and every now and then we have instructions from someone like the promoter Richard Hacklett, or his older cousin, also named Hacklett, who would say, when these people go to China, tell them to take this book along, tell them to take that book along. We have this very well-documented correspondence between the Hacklets that took place in the 1570s about an expedition that was going through the Northeast Passage. Well, we don't have any of that for Hudson. So we, in fact, don't know exactly what Hudson had in his possession. Putting that aside, though it's, I would not dispute the significance of Hudson investigating these northern waters for the resources that they might have. And in fact, that may be some of the, that was probably the most, some of the most important information that came back to England. That said, all of the documents, the most important documents, just suggest that he really is looking for the Northwest Passage. The English had been obsessed with the Northwest Passage at least since the mid-1570s, when the, you know, first the pamphlet and then various people get on the scene, you know, to just sort of describe what, describe both the belief that it exists, because that's what they thought when they would look at their maps, although their maps have no precise knowledge about this, and then sort of the significance of finding it. And it was going to have all sorts of importance for them. I mean, they're all looking for the Northwest Passage. When Captain John Smith goes to Jamestown, he'd like to find the Northwest Passage. I mean, all of these people hope to find this route. And so you could argue, you say, well, maybe Hudson wasn't really looking for it. And, you know, I could say, well, that's an interesting possibility. But is he really getting the investment? This is his fourth cruise, fourth expedition in 4 years. There's a lot of money behind these things. And is he really so out of the mainstream? I mean, it's much more plausible to me that what the English really wanted was a quick way to get to these spices which were going to transform their world than to sort of argue, oh, they anticipated other profits from these Arctic resources. And so I think, you know, look, we're always, these are always going to be debatable points on some level.
And ironically, it's Hudson's voyage that lends lets the English claim Canada, even though he wasn't really going to stay there or colonize it or anything. Hudson is one of the forebears that allow the English to claim Canada.
Exactly, and that's one of the great stories that spins out of this. And so, you know, I talk about this document, you know, in the later part of the decades of the 17th century, where the English are disputing with France because the French claim, Champlain claimed all of Canada for themselves, and the English come back and say, no, 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 by our understanding of international law and the importance of the right of discovery, Hudson was there. Hudson was in these waters, therefore this is English territory.
Let's go to Peter in Dallas. You have a question for Peter Mancall.
Hello?
Peter?
Hi. I wonder if your author could distinguish, he's mentioned both the Inuit and the Cree, and as, hello?
Yes.
And as someone who has traveled in Hudson Bay and in James Bay, you must know that the Cree traditionally only spend time out on the bay during hunting season. And it's the Inuit who are out there all the time. And I wonder if you could say a bit about that.
Thank you very much.
I mean, it's one of those things that's kind of surprising even today that even though James Bay is really far south, all of the islands in it are part of Nunavut.
Well, thank you very much.
Excellent question. Yes, I am indeed aware of those of that distinction. I mean, part of the issue, you know, and it's a sort of, again, one of these sort of historian things is, you know, the documents that we work from the 17th century don't identify any of these people. They just refer to natives, or commonly they refer to them as Americans, which is what Europeans referred to all indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere for a long time before they appropriated the term for themselves as Americans. So there are indeed these distinctions. And so what I've tried to do is use the anthropological materials about Inuit and about Cree to try to recreate or reconstruct who seem to be the likely people that Hudson or his men met at these points of the journey. And I hate to keep falling back on the, you know, the limits of the documentary record, but I mean there are just very deep shortcomings in the record which don't allow the kind of precision that a modern-day observer would see.
And Hudson himself is frustratingly terse. He's not much of a writer.
Hudson himself, even in his best of days, is not particularly voluble. And Hudson's journal, the part which Hudson's journal, you know, part of it which survives, is torn, perhaps getting rid of incriminating evidence about what happened during those 7 months, you know, as they're waiting out for the spring. And so we really don't know a lot of Hudson's views. And so we're just making some, you know, I have to make some inferences about the people he's meeting.
And speaking of the Cree and the Inuit, I called the voyage earlier unlucky. And it struck me as they approach the bay, they keep hoping to find native contacts, and they keep failing and failing and failing. Then finally the mutiny happens and they're headed back, and then they finally meet some Inuit, and that seems to go well, and then they're attacked.
Right.
and it seems inexplicable.
It does seem inexplicable, and it seems inexplicable because of the English. It was inexplicable. I mean, according, again, this goes back to, you know, Prickett's motivation. You know, Prickett just doesn't get it. It's like, hey, we're trading with these people, and we're exchanging signs. I mean, they can't speak to each other, but there has been sort of developed this kind of way of speaking via signs. And, you know, the English thought, hey, things are going okay. And then, obviously, that was not the case. I mean, did the English offend them in some way? You know, we just don't know. Prickett, like a typical English observer of the time, just would attribute this to sort of the inherent irrationality of these, as the Europeans would have called them, uncivilized peoples. Obviously, that was not what was going on. The Inuit, presumably, if the story is true, had good reason for turning on the English. Unfortunately, we don't have any documentation of what that would be.
You've been listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks. I've been filling in for Chris Boyd, who will be back next week. I'd like to thank my guest, historian Peter Mancall. Thanks, Peter.
Well, thank you for having me.
His new book is called Fatal Journey, The Final Expedition of Henry Hudson. And I hope we've made you feel a little cooler in North Texas this afternoon.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.